Hi, I'm Natalie Argarius, and this is the Urbanist Podcast, where we discuss news, information, and ideas about improving cities and quality of life.
And I'm Ray Dubicki. In this week's episode, we're going to talk Initiative 135, Seattle's attempt to build social housing. We'll dig into the initiative, why the Urbanist has endorsed it, and where the criticisms miss the mark. Stick around. So, Natalie, we are in February and facing the countdown to a holiday for hot dates and chocolate, Election Day.
Yeah, it's kind of surprised that, you know, this February 14th, we are going to be voting on a pretty important measure in addition to, you know, maybe enjoying Valentine's Day.
Well, I have my ballot right here, and I am opening it to see. I have the standard City of Seattle Initiative Measure 135 voting ballot, and then the ever popular optional security sleeve. And they actually stuck the local voters pamphlet in the envelope. So if you're waiting on the pamphlet, don't. If you got your ballot already, it's in there.
Yeah, that's a really good tip. And one reason why we decided to do a second podcast on this topic, because we did discuss this a while back, is that that description is pretty long. So it's not necessarily one of those instances where you can kind of just glance at the, the write-up around the measure and know what it's all about.
I am leafing through it, and there's a great statement in favor from Frank Chop, Ty Reed, and Brandon Hershey. And then there's a statement in opposition from a couple of folks who have a couple of complaints about it. But why don't we get into a little bit of what social housing actually is and what we're going to be voting on in order to get everybody to get their ballots in by Tuesday?
I think that's a great idea. So, Ray, since you have the description right there, can you talk to us a little bit about these four pillars of social housing?
The four pillars of social housing are that they are publicly owned, permanently affordable, they are cross-class communities, and they present some resident ownership. Which, you know, it sounds kind of social right off the bat. What do you make of this initial publicly owned part, Natalie?
So basically what it means is that it will be always in public ownership, meaning that we don't have to worry about a private landlord, be it a nonprofit or a for-profit, taking control of it in the future. And that allows for, you know, a lot of different kinds of advantages in terms of long-term planning, the ability to bond, which we might talk about a little bit, against future rents. Having it be owned by the public means that we're all owners of it.
I keep thinking when they talk about public ownership, the city's parks. And while I have a little bit of a disagreement on how we do some of our park ownership structure, we have really said, Seattle has very much said, we want parks to always remain parks. And there was a ballot initiative of that years and years ago, and it has kept green space in the city very stable for a long time. And so why don't we try that with residences too?
I think that's a great comparison to make, and one that's really not often made. You know, there's unfortunately a real stigma against public housing in the United States. Perhaps less in Seattle than some other cities, because we've had examples like Yesler Terrace, which has been seen as one of the most successful public housing communities in the U.S. for decades. This idea, and you know, here we can segue to the permanently affordable as well, because public parks are permanently affordable, right? They're places that are free that we can all go and enjoy together.
Oh, except for the golf courses where they charge a fee in order for the 250,000 people every year to use it, which is less than show up at Seattle Center for, you know, Bumbershoot.
Okay, that is true. And that's a really important caveat to point out. But in large, you know, when we think about the public parks, we're not associating them with a place that you have to pay to get into.
Exactly. And I'll get into my complaints against some of that a little in a different podcast. I won't totally derail this one. But the permanently affordable is a fundamental part of this. It's that, you know, as unstable as Seattle's rents have been over the last few years, and I know I've gotten a notice that my rent was going up a couple of times, these will always remain at a level that people can act. It offers a level of predictability for people to stay in rental housing for a while.
It does. And, you know, what's really nice about the predictability in this particular model of social housing is that it's paying about 30%, not more than 30%, but about 30% of income. And that could be whether your income remains the same, decreases, or increases. And as a result, we can get to that third pillar, which is the idea of the cross-class community. You will have people who are very low income to slightly above median income all living in this housing.
I think that is something that is missing from so much of our neighborhoods these days, because we don't encounter folks who are different than us. We have locked ourselves into gated communities and have suffered for it. So just breaking down the bar between classes made this country great in the past and really could return a whole bunch of civility to our neighborhoods in the future.
There's also a practical aspect too, because the mix of rents will allow for income to actually come into the development. And because it is publicly owned and it is not for profit, that income can be invested in the operating costs, but it can also be used to create more social housing in the future.
I keep thinking about the talk over the last year about stock buybacks in big corporations, where they're using these ridiculous profits not to expand their use of green fuels or build new facilities. And that was kind of what the stock market was supposed to be about. Instead, they're just turning these enormous profits back into cash for the folks who own the stock. And with a publicly owned, permanently affordable mindset, social housing really incentivizes taking the money that comes in and turning it around to make more housing.
Which is something that we really, really need right now. And that's one of the things that's exciting about this, because right now, the tools that we have available to create affordable housing allow, sometimes it's nonprofit developers, mostly it's nonprofit developers, to build or acquire housing, but that's not necessarily going to lead to more in the future, right? It's not like you can say, okay, this is going to generate a stream of revenue that can be used to invest in more affordable housing. It's simply, this project has been accomplished. It's housing this many people. This is actually something that could hopefully snowball an item that is necessary for the public good, as we've all seen here.
That's the hope of it. And I think the last pillar of the four pillars of social housing, resident ownership really emphasizes how this is going to be steered towards housing. That it's not about profits, it's not about operations, it's about building housing for people. And the resident ownership stuff, and we'll get into this in a minute, kind of gets dinged that, oh my gosh, you're going to have the crazies running the asylum. I've been a renter for quite a few years now, and I don't consider myself crazy. So guess what? If I get to be on a board for running the place I live in, I am going to be a great caretaker in order to make sure there is more for everybody.
And I've been able to see this as someone who's fortunate to be a homeowner in a small condo community that's managed by residents. And we're able to, you know, solve our problems and make the decisions that are best for our community, our building, our housing needs. And I think it's great that the initiative will empower people who are living in social housing to have that same opportunity.
Now, we're not totally talking to ourselves here. The Urbanist has endorsed Initiative 135 and was pretty early on the bandwagon in order to get it rolling. Natalie, what were some of the things that we said that our editorial board wisely spoke about when the urbanist decided to endorse the initiative.
And I'm just going to quickly point out that we have an editorial board, but we also have an elections committee, and it was our elections committee that made the decision on this. So I'm part of the editorial board. I believe you are also, Ray, but it's the elections committee that decides, you know, what types of what is the verdict on a particular piece of legislation. And that elections committee is separate for the most part from our writers and the writing we produce.
Dagnabbit, I thought I had all the power here, but you're telling me I don't?
I guess, you know, it's one of those examples of like, there really isn't just one ring to rule them all, right? We all have, you know, different areas in which our power is distributed. And I think that's a good thing. I've actually, you know, I kind of try to distance myself a little bit from the elections committee so I can have some veneer of impartiality when it comes to reporting on a lot of topics.
Oh, wouldn't it be nice if other papers followed suit and didn't really have their publishers sitting on the editorial board? But, we can't ask everything of everyone. What did the Urbanists Elections Committee come up with for endorsing the Initiative 135?
So the first point is that it's the kind of long-term thinking that Seattle needs. So when we authorize the creation of this public developer, we're not, you know, starting the whole process. We're kind of initiating a process that will hopefully evolve and grow over time. So it really requires long-term thinking. And let's be honest, we haven't always been the best about that in Seattle.
I did like the point that the elections committee made in emphasizing that it is big thinking, and it's big thinking by a lot of people, because there's a huge signature gathering initiative where 30,000 signatures were gathered in order to just get this on the ballot. So there are a ton of people around that do want this long-term thinking.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think one of the reasons why is because the affordable housing crisis in the city is not just hitting lower income renters. It's hitting people of all income levels, even people who are high income. And as a result, we need a solution that can address, you know, the problem as it exists for many different kinds of people. And that's what's so exciting about this particular approach to social housing.
The elections committee really emphasized the cross-subsidizing of the cross-class communities, being able to use the money of people who can pay in order to bring up, the idiom is, of course, a rising tide lifts all boats, but this actually puts it into work. And when the elections committee pointed out that cross-subsidizing revenue streams really does help cover the operating costs and allows the possibility of, you know, turning profits on rent into better housing for more people.
And I think that, you know, one piece that also relates to this is we can also see this as a bit of an anti-sprawl tool. So there are a lot of middle and upper middle house income households who, if they're not able to find the housing that they want and they need in Seattle, well, then they're going to move to South King County. They're going to move to Tacoma. They're going to move to Everett. They're going to go to the east side. If we are creating housing that is affordable for people who are working in Seattle, then we can hopefully decrease some of the regional sprawl that I think we've all seen occurring.
I think you just wrote an article on Friday that pointed out there is a rally to save Coal Creek in Issaquah, Sammamish?
Bellevue. It's technically Bellevue. In Bellevue. It's near Newcastle. And
okay.
The parcel is within, it's adjacent to the Coal Creek Natural Area, which is a really beautiful wild land in Bellevue. And also, it serves as an important connector between Coal Creek and then Cougar Mountain Park, which, as you can imagine, there's a lot of wildlife who will move through the corridor. And unfortunately, there are two parcels that were acquired by a developer that are hoping to make them into single family homes. And it's just one example of sprawl. But the fact of the matter is that people are moving here. We are not creating the housing that people need. And if they can afford it, they will move farther and farther away to have it. Not necessarily because they want to, but because they have to.
So in the urbanist efforts to keep good forested land preserved, we can say, come into Seattle and there's actually going to be a mechanism for affordability. And that is part of the ballot that we're dealing with this week.
When you think about it, the public developer can charge rents to up to 30% of an individual or a household's income. That's affordable, but that's not deeply affordable. A lot of homeowners pay less than that, particularly if they've been holding onto their properties for a long time. So this is really, to my point of view, more about creating housing that is accessible to people who are working in Seattle.
And the people who are working in Seattle are, you know, our teachers and firefighters and the folks who actually make things in the industrial areas. And goodness, if they could save time of not having to drive in, imagine how much better everybody's lifestyle is going to be.
So the last point that we should touch on related to the urbanist's endorsement is land banking, which is the fact that the way that the initiative is written, the public developer would have a first right of refusal on land that becomes publicly available in Seattle, which is great because we have not always seen that land being put to its highest and best use. And there are a lot of reasons for that, but this would enable the public developer to decide, hey, is this suitable for housing? And then if it is, it can pursue developing housing there.
I like the part of the ballot initiative that actually says we got to do a survey of all of the stuff that is going of all the city's land that is going to be available at some point in time. And just having that survey alone can really let us take a look at what the city has as this enormous asset, which is developable property. And to be able to have a mechanism created parallel to that survey that will at some point be able to take ownership of that land and keep it perpetually affordable and publicly owned, I think that alone is a giant asset too.
So now I think it's important for us to move on to discuss some of the criticisms of the initiative, because it's long, it's complicated. I'm not going to just pretend like, oh, it's just these four pillars and it's going to be so easy to do this. It won't be. At the same time, I think that there are a lot of ways in which we can provide counter arguments to these criticisms that are substantial. And I think it's important to do this because we don't want something that could be as important of a tool as social housing could be for our city to simply get shot down without a very good reason.
One of the bigger voices that has come out against social housing has been the Seattle Times and their editorial board, which does have the publisher sitting on it. Has a couple of points that they tried to blow Initiative 135 out of the water. Unfortunately, the counterarguments don't seem particularly, they're based on a whole lot of misconceptions. I really want to call them straw men, but there's some, they really play with the fact that it is a complicated piece of legislation creating something new, and that they can just kind of, and the Seattle Times can just kind of raise a question without actually being able to do a whole lot of research to find out that, nope, that's covered. And they think that that is the nub of opposition.
And that's where we can kind of go to their first major criticism, which is that this ballot initiative has no funding source. And that was deliberate. It's something that is pretty easy to, to respond to because of that. And that's because the state law barred initiative drafters from setting up a public development authority and a new revenue source in a single ballot measure.
Now, it's interesting that the Seattle Times doesn't come out against a whole lot of different public development authorities, and the state has a ton, because these public development authorities often are not set up without a direct funding mechanism attached. So the state law says the state or the city is allowed to create a public development authority, and that's the category that Initiative 135 falls under. And then other mechanisms, other budgets, other jurisdictions are allowed to fund them.
Exactly. And there is a little bit of language, you know, related to funding in the initiative. The intent is for this to be funded by progressive revenue. There also is the instruction for the Seattle City Council to aid in setting up a revenue source, but the kind of aid that they are asking for is essentially like office space, I think, and maybe maybe a little bit on top of that, but just to kind of get things kicked off.
I followed the establishment of the Armory Public Development Authority in Inner Bay, and the initiative that did not have an initiative that was set up by state law. And there was a budget item allotted for it that was essentially just office space. It is the initiative. It is the part to get it off the ground. And then part of that office's job then becomes identifying the actual funding sources. So I find this argument against it being a kind of a deliberate misunderstanding of the way that some of these public development authorities get off the ground.
That's a great point to bring up. So the next part where I think there is a bit of a deliberate misunderstanding is their critique of the business model. So the Seattle Times claims that because tenants will have the right to stay, even if their incomes decrease, the social housing developer will not get private financing, and then local government will be on the hook for both capital and operating expenses. So number one, the Times has not shown their work in this regard. They've not shown, you know, this phenomenon occurring elsewhere or played it out in terms of expenses or even given specific examples of types of private financing that the public development authority would be excluded from. But the other, you know, the other thing to point out is this, is that the even if the local government were to be on the hook, and it may not be local, it may be state, maybe whatever, but even if there were some kind of government subsidy to be coming into this, it would still be more affordable because you still would have a mix of rents than any other model, I believe, that we have happening right now. So
it's unfortunate because this is really one of those, oh, we're just asking the question, kind of poking a hole in a big, complex piece of legislation. And the Times should know better than that. I mean, they have an entire newsroom of people doing research and interviewing people. And this was just lazy, quasi-opposition coming up with something to see if it sticks against the wall.
And then so the next one is a critique of the governing structure. And I think, you know, part of this is cultural. We don't really have a strong culture of tenant advocacy in the United States. In Seattle, I think we have more actually than in most places with our tenant rights commission at the city. Mm-hmm. But it's just not something that's really been a large part of the housing landscape for renters in the U.S. We have a lot of owner advocacy and owner governing structures, actually, but not for tenants. And so it just, in my point of view, that creates, you know, this sort of tension and this idea, oh, well, if the tenants are too involved in how this is governed, it's going to create a conflict of interest. Well, my question is, why? Because they're the ones who live there. Will it result in them excluding other people from live there? I don't believe so. Will it result in them, I don't know, plating their lobbies in gold? I doubt it. I don't know. What do you think? What are these potential conflicts of interest that could arrive?
I think it's a completely made up concept that a renter being on a board is going to have a conflict of interest. It's as dumb of an argument as saying renters shouldn't be able to vote in the city because they're not landowners. And the idea of being able to have a renter's board and then complaining that it makes it too difficult to evict tenants is based in this backwards ancient concept that, oh, renters have no stake in their communities. And I have to say, I'm a renter. I have a great stake in the community. I have a great stake in the house that I live in. And I find this to be such a condescending argument that it is infuriating. One of the things that comes out of it in the Seattle Times editorial against Initiative 135 is that they settle back in to this doesn't start, that the initiative does not start by immediately housing everybody who doesn't have a house. Their opposition to it comes from a place of caring too much about the homeless. And why should we be skipping past those folks in order to build this brand new conceptual idea that might not work?
So I'll say this, if, you know, the purpose of this initiative were to say, okay, starting from 6 months after the passage of this initiative, the only funding that we'll be putting toward affordable housing in the city will be for social housing. We will no longer be, you know, having funding going into the creation of permanent supportive housing, for example, which is the housing that people who are living unsheltered are most likely to move into, mm-hmm. particularly people who may have medical needs or be substance addicted. So if that were the case, then I think that critique could stand, but it's not. Because this is not meant to be replacing anything else. This is simply saying we are going to create a mechanism by which we can create housing that is affordable for a broader cross-section of people. And I think we can all agree, and I think the data shows, that people who are middle income, people who are even slightly above median income in the city, are also struggling with housing.
When we're talking about being able to charge up to 30% somebody's income in rent, that is still an enormous amount of money for a household to be able to simply have a roof over their head. And so with the expense that housing is in the city right now and in the region, to be honest, it is no question that so many people are struggling based on rent. For the Times to make the argument that that Initiative 135 skips past the most pressing need, doesn't recognize that there is an enormous pressing need for many, many people in the region to have an affordable home of their own.
Yeah, and that's where you've written in the past about bad faith arguments, Ray. I feel like this is a real example of a bad faith argument. It's saying, oh, we just care so much about people who are homeless right now that we can't possibly allow for the creation of another model of housing that could actually, you know, house some people who have no income. That's explicitly written into the initiative. It's from 0 to 120% of area median income.
And the Times gets to skip straight past that particular recognition and say, oh my gosh, we just, like you said, oh my gosh, we just care so much. And I don't see it in any of the other things that they keep, any of the other attempts to shoot down housing initiatives and legislation.
And the next criticism that not only the Seattle Times put forth, but also the Housing Developer Consortium, better known as HDC, which represents nonprofit housing developers throughout the region, they put forth the idea that if Seattle approves this initiative, it will jeopardize the passage of the housing levy next year. Just as a quick explainer, the housing levy is a 7-year levy that is really the cornerstone for funding affordable housing in Seattle. It helps to create and preserve over 15,000 affordable rental homes. And it also is used toward about 1,000 home ownership opportunities in the city. It's been around for about 40 years. And to give you an idea of how much it would take for the housing levy to fail, when it was approved last, which is in 2016, it was approved by over 70% of voters.
That's such a squeaker. I mean, 70% of voters. I mean, really, that seems like a just staunch opposition to affordable housing in the city.
And, you know, this is where I think it's also important to bring up the fact that right now, Initiative 135 is just about creating the public developer. It's not locking the city into a certain level of funding, right? So it's not like saying, okay, right, we're taking the housing levy and we're doubling it. No, it's not. It's simply creating a new tool by which housing can be created. So the idea that people would not should not vote for this simply because it would jeopardize the housing levy, to me, seems to also be in bad faith.
In the initiative itself, it actually says this is trying to be funded through progressive revenue. And what is less progressive than yet another levy? So they're actually looking for funding Initiative 135 in the statement of the bill, not at levy stuff. Like, literally, this comes as a straw man type of argument saying, we do all of this with this particular type of money, and this is just going to be another slice coming out of the pie. And that's not true.
Exactly. And the, you know, this kind of lands us at the final criticism we had, which is that it's going to pit the current nonprofit developers that we have against this public development authority. Well, if we were operating in a landscape of scarcity in which, you know, there wasn't really a strong demand for affordable housing and these, you know, nonprofit developers were really, you know, they have their work cut out for them. There is more work than they can accomplish. If you talk to any of them, if you read about what's going on with them, it's not like they're operating in a climate of scarcity. There are some challenges that relate to funding. That's absolutely true. But the need is so great that having a new tool enter into the environment is not going to put them, is not going to be placing a threat to their model.
The Initiative 135 supporters, House Our Neighbors, has done a very good job of describing this as the pie issue. That these complaints are, oh my gosh, we have to cut the pie into more pieces. All of us are going to get less pie. And the Initiative 135 folks have been saying, what? Cook more pies. And that is exactly what the initiative does, in that it allows, instead of having just the levy as the source of affordable housing in the city, it opens up the opportunity for other types of financing to come in and pay for affordable housing that are not being tapped right now.
That's a very good point. So, you know, we have to think of this as a larger landscape. And looking at how things stand right now, the two main drivers of new affordable housing creation in Seattle are mandatory housing affordability, MHA, and the multifamily tax exemption, MFTE. And there are some similarities between how these two programs operate and the concept of social housing. For instance, MFTE provides tax exemptions to developers for affordable units that are within private market rate developments. So you do have a creation of a cross-income community there. And then with MHA, the developer has two choices. They can either provide affordable housing on site, which historically has not been many developers' choice. That housing, I believe, has to be affordable for about 100 years. So yep, it's a long-term, you know, it's a long-term commitment. Or they pay into a fund, which is used to acquire affordable housing. And what we've seen is that the city has been able to give out a lot of grants to nonprofit agencies to build and acquire affordable housing units since we've been able to reap those MHA funds.
I like the idea that that you bring up, that this is a landscape of ways that we are paying for new affordable homes in the city. And the levy is part of that landscape. The MHA and MFTE tax exemption are also part of that landscape. But really, I think the perspective is that those are such small parts of the overall opportunities to get resources that could be going into affordable housing that the city has spent so long focusing on these three things that there's a lot of folks, and the Seattle Times among them, can't even imagine going past the walls of these.
And, you know, the issue here is that we do not have the tools necessary at our disposal right now to meet the scale of the problem. I think that's painfully evident to everyone. And we don't have a means by which we can really amplify some of these current tools very easily. So why not add a new tool into the mix at the same time by which, you know, we are seeking to shore up and continue with what we already have?
I will throw out there that I think some of the idea of social housing does get a bad perception because of the social word at the very beginning of it. And there is this mindset of, oh my gosh, we're going back to, like you said, public housing, that we're going to Soviet style apartment blocks. And then when we mention there are other places in the world that do social housing really, really well, and the elections board actually brought up Vienna does this, Singapore does this, that adds to this mindset of, oh my gosh, it is foreign and it is going to result in just gross, ugly, dilapidated concrete brutalism, and we will not be able to do anything about it.
I think that the fact that it's foreign, on the one hand, is a cause for concern because it's hard to see how it will fit into our American economic model for housing. That I think is legitimate to bring up. But on the other hand, I think one of its best attributes is the fact that it's foreign because, you know, we do not have a lock on all the good ideas in the world, right? You know, our economic model, it has, you know, its strong points and its weak points. And we're hopefully as a society always trying to evolve into something better. And so if we see something is working really well elsewhere, and, you know, both of the places you mentioned, Austria, Vienna, Singapore, they're capitalist. In fact, Singapore is known for being a very capitalist society. So it's not like we haven't seen this thrive within capitalism. It has. We just have to be open to the idea that we can take something from elsewhere, bring it here, and also kind of make it our own. Well, for a second podcast on this topic, I think we had a lot to say, but that's because it's a big and exciting topic, and we genuinely hope that you will get your ballots completed and postmarked by the 14th.
Actually going to take a moment, and I am going to fill out my circle right now. Should this measure be approved? Yes. Vote yes on initiative number 135 in the city of Seattle. And then I will drop this ballot off in its envelope on my way to lunch this afternoon.
Sounds like a plan. And so while you are finishing that up, Ray, I'm just going to quickly address this week's letters and corrections from earlier episodes. So we got a note from Spencer Rittering about last week's episode on automation. Spencer writes, I think this could have been a much better episode if you went deep on how dehumanizing our lived environment either improves or degrades our life. What is the impact of students not having real humans available to work through problems, and instead all they have is the internet on a tablet? While you scratch the surface toward the end, describing it as a hellscape really didn't add anything. Spencer, I agree with you. I think that you have pitched us a really interesting topic for another podcast. And I hope in the future we'll be able to, do some investigation into this idea of, you know, how will a more automated existence, when we're thinking of the built environment, make our lives better or worse or some combination of the two. And I look forward to, approaching it in the future.
And I reserve the right to describe anything as a dystopian hellscape and consider it an additive concept.
If there's something that you do want us to talk about in a future podcast, or that you did enjoy in a podcast, or that you want to dunk on us about, don't hesitate to email us at podcast@theurbanist.org.
And once again, if you're in the city of Seattle, fill out your ballot for Initiative 135. Drop it off, put it in the mail, and we look forward to seeing you next week with some good news about the initiative.
Hopefully we'll have news of a successful election. But until then, I'm Natalie Argarius.
And I'm Ray Dubicki. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk again soon.